In this part of Focus, we'll be talking about the idea of private ownership of land and how it is that that idea got so firmly established here in the United States. It's something that we really take for granted and think of as being a kind of bedrock American principle and ideal. Yet it is something that originated fairly recently. And to a lot of people, a lot of places around the world, the idea of private ownership of land is still a very strange idea. Our guest for this hour of the show is John Hanson Mitchell. He's the author of a number of books, all of them, one way or another, dealing with the idea of place. To name some of the titles of his books, they include Ceremonial Time, Living at the End of Time, Walking Towards Walden, and the book that we'll be talking about here this morning, which is entitled Trespassing, An Inquiry into the Private Ownership of Land. The book is published by Addison Wesley, is out now, and makes good reading. You might want to take a look at it. Our guest is also editor of Sanctuary Magazine. I know a lot of people admire his writing, and we're pleased to have him here with us, joining us by phone, to talk about the book Trespassing and this idea of private ownership of land. As we do talk, you should certainly feel free to pick up the telephone and give us a call, join in the conversation. All we ask is that people are brief in their comments so that we can accommodate as many different callers as possible and keep the program moving along. But anybody's welcome to call, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, locally. That's what you get if you match the numbers and the letters on the phone, 333-WILL, and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Mr. Mitchell, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Well, you're welcome.
I want to ask you about something that is here in the book in Trespassing in the back, where it talks about the author, and it says that, as I mentioned, that most of your writing deals with the idea of place, and it says here, before settling on the square mile that is the subject of his previous books, he was an inveterate trespasser.
Yeah.
Tell me about that. Let's talk about trespassing.
Well, I grew up in a town that, for some reason, they didn't have strong property lines. I mean, I think most kids do this. I mean, they just wander over other people's property. And I had two older brothers who were pretty good wanderers themselves, and they sort of taught me the art of just crossing property lines. And unlike other adults, so when I grew up, I didn't stop doing that. I loved to walk, and I loved to poke around in odd places. So I just kept on trespassing, basically. I mean, also, I like birds, and anybody who, birds and mammals don't follow property lines, so I just, it's a habit that I picked up, and then it fit right in with this theme of who owns the land and why and how. So it quite matched.
Well, it seems to me that that both of these ideas we're talking about, the ability to wander freely and the idea of private property, are both very American ideas. Now, it may be that the ability to, the freedom to wander has become a minority position, you have to find strong advocates. Sometimes you have to go back to people like Mr. Thoreau, who is, I know, you're sort of an admirer of his, and kind of following those same footsteps, but it's interesting that both of these things seem to be really very much a part of us, and of course are in conflict.
Absolutely. I mean, this is, as you say, they're both deeply rooted American traditions. On the one hand, you have, my home is my castle, and every man or woman's home is his or her castle. I mean, and the private property is inviolate. You can do what you want once you own the land, you can do what you want there. Nobody can stop you, neither the government nor any individual. And then contrasting that, you have the myth of the lure of the frontier. If something goes wrong where you are in the American mind, you light out for the territories, for the freedom to roam, and where you're absolutely free. There's nobody telling you what to do. So you have these conflicting forces in the American culture and makes it all the more interesting.
There is a story that is woven throughout the book Trespassing, and perhaps I'd ask you to talk a little bit, tell a little bit of that story.
Right.
And that is this story of the this place that had been an Indian village for a long, long time, and then the Indians were Christianized, and they continued to live there. This place that came to be known as Neshoba Plantation, and there's a story of one individual that really runs through this. That was the last of these Indian people to live there, who eventually deeded it over to some English Americans or American English people. Tell us about this place.
Well, it's an interesting little area. I mean, this is a complex story, and in order to tell it, you know, to hold it together, it's only about 500 acres, and it was, as you say, the site of an Indian village. Probably no one knows how long. I mean, it could have been, you know, a couple of thousand years. And then in the 1600s, the mid-1600s, the Indians who lived there were Christianized, and they were granted the land outright under English law. In other words, these Indians owned the land just as any English person would. It was the same. It was the same. It had all the rights that the English had until the King Philip's War came along. The Indians rose up against the English, and it's really what happened to these Indians is the same thing that happened to the Nisei in Second World War. They just, even though they were rightful owners of this property, they were, taken out of the village and put on internment camps on Deer Island out in Boston Harbor, where a lot of them died. But after the war, one individual came back to this 500-acre tract where the village was located, a woman named Sarah Doublet. And her life is fairly obscure, but the end of it is better documented. She came back, and she held on to that. She still had the legal rights to the village, and she was the last survivor of these Neshoba people, the people who lived, the Indians who lived at the Neshoba plantation. And she probably lived to be about 100. And everybody was after this property. It's a good piece of land. It's got a pond there. It's got, strange. It's a center for earthquakes. It's an epicenter for earthquakes. I mean, it's a very interesting area. She held on to that land until she died. And she probably lived to be about 100. Incredibly long lived. She didn't die until 1736. So I used that tract, that story. I mean, this land was under the Indians, was under the Christian Indians under English law, and then finally after Sarah died, it was under the English, and then in 1776 became America. Mm. So I used that, that small plot of land, just 500 acres, to tell this wide-ranging story of, property rights and why we think we own the land.
Yeah. And I guess sort of another facet of this is the stories of people who now own that land and live around the area, and their the way they feel about it, and in a sense also their interest in, while they own it and say this is mine, in a sense they also seem, there's sort of a curious blend of ownership and preservation in a semi undisturbed state, because there's another story here is sort of conflict resistance to the developing part of this land.
Right. Well, see, this it's interesting. There are 16 of these Indian villages, Christianized Indian villages, around in New England. This is the only one that's so far undeveloped. I mean, there are a few houses around. There are two ponds and a couple of houses around one of the lakes, one of the ponds, but. Other than that, a lot of it's apple orchard, owned by one old curmudgeon, a guy named Morrison, who holds on to that. He held on to his property. He fought off all manner of developers, and including trespassers. He doesn't like people trespassing in there, so that set up a conflict in the book. But then, and other owners or other people around that area. Almost all of these people are very good stewards. Everybody takes care of the land there. And there's one guy, and old farmer who never wears shoes, and he slightly eccentric fellow, and he too was a great caretaker of the property, and he worked for Morrison, and so there's a lot of different, and then at the doors, at the gates, barking at the gates, because it's a beautiful piece of property, are developers, people who want to see this land turned into housing or whatever, large, you know, what they call around here trophy houses, these immense palaces that, 16, 22-room houses with only two people living in them. And so it's got all these conflicts, this piece of property, and all these characters, too.
Yeah. Let me reintroduce our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with writer John Hanson Mitchell. He's the author of a number of books, including Ceremonial Time, Living at the End of Time, Walking Towards Walden. His most recent, which looks at this idea of how it is we develop the idea of private ownership of land, is titled Trespassing. And it is published by Addison Wesley. Is out now in bookstores. Certainly should be able to be the book that you could find. I think it came out in May. And it's good reading. If you would like to take a look at it, you should. And, of course, you can be a part of this conversation by picking up the telephone, giving us a call, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers. You say some sort of interesting things about going back to England before the ideas that we have of private ownership came along, about how people lived, and I guess that we trace many of our traditions indeed to England and English ideas about law and so forth. This going back before William the Conqueror, I think he was the one who really changed things a lot because he came along and decided everything is mine. But before that, there was this sort of interesting idea that In a sense, everything is everybody's, and there was sort of an agreement about common use of land and common ownership.
Yeah, this whole idea of private property, I mean, it comes out of English common law, but ironically, it really, in England, I mean, the idea of the commons, of working together on a piece of property, was much stronger than it is in this country. And especially before William the Conqueror, before 1066. Basically the way it worked is you had a village, and the village might have as many as, or as few, as 200 people living there. And they would share all their resources. In other words, they might, of those 200 families, there might only be seven oxen, or even as few as four plows. So they would rotate the use of those oxen and those plows, and they would, work together and share the workload, and actually share the land, too. They had a system where they would sort of divvy up the land to one family one year and then rotate it. So you had one field one year, might not be a good field, might be poor soil, unknown to be poor, but that's only for that one year. Next year you'd get a better one. So it all rotated, and it worked. This is a feudalistic system, mind you. I mean, there's a lord at the top, and all the way down to serfs who are essentially slaves. However, it functioned, and it functioned for 2,000 years, and the land. The land produced food, and the woods produced forest products, including acorns and beech nuts, what they call mast, it was a steady state system, which is what we really all should seek in our time. And then along came private property, and all bets were off. Things changed, but the basic root, the idea of common land and common sharing of resources, that really was very strong in England before William.
Well, it's somehow I have this idea that that in some sense, maybe slightly modified, that also existed, at least in the early in early America, at least in the Northeast.
It did, yes, yeah, it did. When they first came here, Well, Plymouth Plantation itself actually was a veritable communist experiment. They had, when they first came, they had a pact which I don't think anybody owned anything. They shared everything. Now, that only lasted about 8 years, and then they went, and then they moved back into the sort of the English system with the commons and the common lands and the shared fields and everything. But earlier on, it was a tremendous social experiment, really. Now, with the Puritans, when they came, it was a little different. They were basically using the English model, and here in New England and parts of the Midwest too, Ohio especially, you still have here these commons. You have, you know, the village. In the older villages, you have a church, and you have a green, a common in front of the church, and around that around the common and the green and the church are the houses, and that's a 500-year-old land use pattern. Oh, and then behind the houses you have the fields. So that system, especially in New England, and then the New Englanders moved to the Midwest, so they carried it to the Midwest too. You had that old English model. Elsewhere you don't. American West and the American South had a different system of distribution of land.
We have a caller to talk with. Why don't we do that? They're in Urbana, and we'll bring them into the conversation here. They're on line number one.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I wondered if your guests could maybe comment on three ideas about land that's kind of interests me. The first idea is the idea that once a municipality or a government or even a utility company decides they need to do something with the land, this concept of eminent domain and that the balance of serving the public good versus, you know, someone else owns the property and they don't want to give it up. Sometimes people are simply, you know, the house is bought and destroyed, or the government can claim, you know, superior rights over that private ownership. The second concept I was thinking about was this word, the increasing trend toward land being bought up by people that are not from the area. We often see land being sold to this word called developer, and they are often from out of town with a different vision than perhaps what the locals might want to see for the land. And also, the third idea I was hoping you'd address was the idea that when land functions as a public right-of-way, such as a sidewalk in a business district or a shopping mall, that people who do not conform to how the land is supposed to be used, such as sitting, perhaps even living, or not dressed appropriately for that space, are oftentimes asked to leave, even though the land functions as a public right-of-way. And I'll hang up and listen to your comments.
Well, very, very interesting and all related. I'll take the last one first because I don't know the answer. their right to be there is, I think that's probably written into the law. Their behavior is a different matter, and I don't know about their manner of dress.
Thank you.
phenomenon. In the past, the land, you know, could have been developed, but it was usually developed by somebody local. And this this question of outside entities, corporations even, coming in, buying up the property, and totally altering the system is relatively new, and I think that comes right out of this whole idea of private property. It comes right out of the idea of ownership. It doesn't matter what the local traditions are. According to the law, you own it. You can do what you want with it, in theory. Now, that leads to your first question, which is really the most complex, this idea of eminent domain that you can, you know, even though you own the land outright, can the government, be it the, you know, the king or the U.S. government, come along and say, look, we want this land for a reservoir. I know you and your family have lived here for five generations, and I know you've cared for this land and, you know, improved these soils and taken off five generations of crops from this land, but we can't help it. We need it, and it's for the general good. And they actually, under the Constitution, have the right to do that. The government has the right to do that. It's in the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution. However, and this is the big fight that's going on all over the West nowadays, is the so-called Takings Clause of the Fifth Amendment says, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. And so government can come along and say, look, we want your farm, here's the money, and they can do that. However, what if you, what if the government, you know, this is the flip side of that, what if they say, you can't put your hog farm there, or you can't put your house there because it's going to flood, or you can't put your hog farm there because it's going to, you know, hurt the general environment around you. And this guy, whoever wants to do this to the land, owns it outright. The government says, you can't do that because it's going to hurt the public good. Are they taking the land by prohibiting you from doing what you want with it, or are they not? And that's called the takings argument, and it's a major fight going on in the environmental community these days. What constitutes a taking? How do you decide whether the government or government regulation has taken your land away from you? And it's a major issue.
Well, it seems that also we don't really often agree on what constitutes public good either.
Right. Absolutely. And, you know, developer, guy who, the biggest case, so there's one of these cases went to the Supreme Court, and there was a developer in South Carolina, and he had property on a beachfront known to be threatened constantly by hurricanes. Mm. Constantly. I mean, every few years a hurricane comes by and sweeps all the houses away. So he bought the land, he started to put up houses. The South Carolina Coastal Commission said, no, you can't put your house there. We're not going to be responsible for this. And so this developer, Lucas, said, but I can. I own this land. And that case went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And they actually decided in favor of the developer. The Supreme Court did.
Yeah.
So he got to put his houses up there. Now, you know, he sells his house. People move in. Happy families move in. 5 years from now, hurricane comes by and destroys a house. Developers back, as your caller said, you know, he lives someplace else. He lives in Washington, D.C. Hurricane comes, sweeps his house away, not my fault. So, you know, these laws are trying to protect people, but they do get sticky.
Yeah. We're about midway through this part of Focus. Let me introduce once again our guest for this part of the program. John Hanson Mitchell is a writer. He's written a number of books, and one way or another, they deal with the idea of the sense of place and how we think about land and how people, what sort of connections there are between people and the natural environment. Again, your questions and comments are welcome if you'd like to be a part of the conversation. It's very easy to do that for people who are here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are. The number is 333-9455. Also, we do have a toll-free line, and that one is good any place that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. And again, if you match the numbers with the letters on the phone, you get WILL. So it's 333-WILL and toll free, 800-222-WILL. It seems a little ironic to me, in a sense, that that people who left England to get away from the class system that existed there and the power of the crown would come here and, in a sense, recapitulate this way of thinking about land ownership and, in a sense, want to be creating these mini manors. And that is, after all, why it is we have lawns, you know, because it's the life of the country squire writ small. But it does seem to be that is an idea that these English people brought with them from England to this country.
Yeah, I find that so interesting, this fact that they, you know, as you say, they came over here with the idea of getting away from the power structure and to establish, you know, religious freedom and freedom, political freedom. And as soon as they got here, you know, I mean, we did have the idea of the commons, and that lasted forever, still lasts to some degree, but right away they started using this whole idea of private property too. I mean, that evolved here very strongly. It came out of this English system called the allodial system. But and then they get their private property, and what do? But turn around and become manor lords. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the lawn, as you say, the lawn is sort of symbolic of that. The great manors of England all had sheep meadows in front of them, and the lawn comes right out of that tradition, and so does the whole idea of, you know, this is my place, I can do what I want with it. That's what the manor lord did. The manor lord, or the feudal lord, said, look, this is my fiefdom. I can do with what I want here. You know, the king, only the king and the king's army could control him. So, yeah, it is. There's a deep-rooted irony in this American tradition. Mm.
How is it that, what sort of line of reasoning actually that led the crown to this idea that they could deed to people big pieces of this new country that was across the sea and presumably might have belonged to someone, or there might have been some conflicting rights? And how did they get this idea that they could sit down and write out this piece of paper and could give to somebody, you know, give them the state of Virginia or what became the state of Virginia, or some such thing, a huge piece of territory, just to say, here, this is yours, I'll sign this piece of paper, and there you go.
Well, that's a good question. The main part of it is that the king, and it's still true under English law, basically, you know, even the manor lord did not own the land. Nobody owned the land. Only the king owned the land. The king owned England. The queen, to this day, owns the swans of England. But when they got here to the so-called New World, the reason they were able to claim, the kings and the French kings too, were able to claim this, is this whole idea of what they call terra nullius, which means land owned by nobody. And, you know, under the native rights, you know,
thank you.
not consider that they, well, it comes right out of the Bible, actually. It comes out of Genesis, subdue the earth and have dominion over the animals and the plants. And if they were not doing that, if they were not subduing the earth and having dominion over, you know, ducks and geese and cattle, then they had no rights to the land, according to the English system. And so that's the argument they used. And so the king would say, look, he said to the Massachusetts Bay Company, you know, the Puritans, people came over and settled Boston. He said, you own this land from the east coast of North America all the way to the Pacific. And that was the grant. So he can do that legally. Under English law, they could say that. Now, never mind that there were people here. You know, that problem came later. But in the beginning, they could just claim this for England. And Spain and France could do the same.
Mm-hmm. Is there some possibility that we could recover some idea of common ownership and common good in land use, or do you think that we have so the idea of private property is now so firmly established that there's probably no going back?
No, the idea of the common is coming back, actually. A lot of communities around the United States have what they call land trusts. There's one that bought sections of the Neshoba property, which this book deals with. The trusts, these are you know, made up of groups of people in a community who want to save a certain tract of land. And what they do is they either get the money up themselves or they raise it through government funds, and they'll buy outright a piece of property and then open it up to the public. So commons, the idea of the common, which is, you know, it's an excellent idea. Commons is a good system. And it's increasing. And we have around here in the East where, you know, the farms are all, so many farms are threatened here. You have communities that are actually managing through various legal systems to preserve the farms. Sometimes they buy them outright and turn them into community farms where people can have their gardens. And in other systems, they buy the crop. The farmer stays on the land, but the community buys the crop before the farmer plants it. It's called community-supported agriculture, and that's basically the commons. That's going right back to the old English idea of the commons.
Yeah.
So, it's an idea who's sort of coming around again.
Well, that's interesting, because we actually do have some folks who do community-supported agriculture here, and I guess I hadn't really thought about it quite in that way, since the land belongs to the person who does the farming, and yet, you know, you have these people who sort of share in the expense and share in the yield, and if it's good, it's good, and like this year, it hasn't been so good, but, you know,
right.
Sort of you take the ups and the downs.
Yeah, it's a bit of a gamble, but it goes right back to the old system of the commons, and it works.
Well, let's talk with another caller here. They're in Urbana again, line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
A long time ago, I remember tuning in on a discussion of water rights, and it seemed like a foreign language. Is it the case that our notions currently about water rights, streams and rivers that flow through people's private property, is not descended from the same tradition? It sounded like all the rules, the regulations, the even thinking about it was different. Have you got a sense of where that tradition and practice comes from? Let me hang up and listen.
Yeah, you're right. It's almost a whole other system of laws called riparian rights, and I actually don't get into that, water rights, in the book, because trespassing, because it is so complex, and it's so different and so various. However, it is out of the same root of the whole idea of owning something, owning the resources. But it gets, when you, you know, when you get into the idea of flooding, you get into the idea of pollution, you get into the idea, most complex of all, is rivers don't tend to stay in their beds as they are supposed to, as you probably know. And there was a famous case out in, what was the river? Colorado. I think it was the Colorado River changed course back in the 1860s and, you know, cut out a whole section of an Indian reservation, which the whites moved on to and then claimed for theirs. And then, you know, 100 years later, the Indians came back and said, wait a minute, that really is our land. It just gets so complex over these water systems, and it's even more complex in England, where you have fishing rights, and in England, if a stream runs through a manor lord's property, that manor lord, in theory, controls. I don't think he owns, but he controls who. He controls the fish in that stream. And so you know, a friend of mine did a kayak trip, canoe trip through England, and at one point he was on the river, and the gamekeeper came out and said, look, you can't come on this river. You can't put your boat, have your boat run through here. This is our river. And the same thing is happening it's in Georgia, the river where the movie Deliverance was made. A developer has come in there. He's bought land on either side of the river, the banks on either side of the river. This is a favorite canoeing river, favorite whitewater river for people in that area. This developer is saying, you can no longer take your boats down this river. He's blocked it off, and he, you know, claims he's going to shoot people who go through there. So, totally different animal. You know, this idea of water rights, and I purposely steered clear of it because this is a book about land rights, and it's a good question. You could do a whole nother book on the waters.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus, talking with writer John Hanson Mitchell. His most recent book does deal with the idea of private ownership of land and land rights. It's titled Trespassing, and it's published by Edison Wesley. Out now in bookstores if you want to take a look at it. Our guest is the author of a number of books. You can look for some of them as well in the bookstore of the library. They include Ceremonial Time, Living at the End of Time, Walking Towards Walden. He's editor of Sanctuary Magazine and makes his home in Littleton, Massachusetts, and is talking with us by telephone this morning. And questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers if you want to call in. I want to get back to the beginning of the program, we sort of sketched out the story of Neshoba and of Sarah Doublet, this Christian Indian village that had been an Indian village for a long time. Then the English came in and Christianized the Indians, but said, as long as you behave like good English people, you can live there. Until the point there was a war, they were relocated. Most of them died. One woman came back, and she was the one who eventually was the last, Sarah Doublet was the last person to live there, and when she was quite elderly, was befriended. At least that seems like maybe what happened, or maybe they were just interested in the land. Anyway, by two men who said that we'll take care of you in exchange for you deeding over the land to us, which she did. Tell me some more about, you know, what it is about this particular story. I mean, it's a great story, first of all, and you tell it really nicely throughout the book, and encourage us to imagine what life there would have been for the native people, and take us through the story. But what is it about this particular story that engages you?
Well, two things. First is it was a very convenient way to tell the story, as I tell the story of land ownership. On the one hand, on the other hand, there's a very interesting angle to this whole piece of property, and that is that it might be, or might have been, and might still be, in fact, sacred land for Sarah and her people. And what happened was, the this is the theory is that the English came to these Indians, they Christianized them, and they said, okay, you want a village. Where do you want to put your village? And they said, well, we'll put it here. Well, what they didn't say was they were Christians in name only, probably. And this was a convenient way of preserving what was essentially their sacred lands. And I've been told by historians that they would give up their agricultural lands. They would give up their hunting grounds. They would give up this. They'd give up that. The last areas that they wanted to give up on were the sacred territories. So this piece of property, you go there, it's very interesting. It's got the earth periodically rumbles at that point. That means there's an earthquake. They believe the four winds were pent up in one of the hills, but we claim that this is a region of earthquakes. And there are two ponds there. Any body of water would have been very important to the Native Americans. They believe that was a sort of an entry point to the spirit world. Furthermore, there are these very strange rock formations in this piece of property. There are all these these high sort of battlements. They look like they're cliffs, and they're in the middle of the woods for no apparent reason, and they look like battlements. And then there's some mounds, like serpent mounds, which here in the East are very uncommon. Like effigy mounds and things like that you see in this region. So all indications are that this was probably sacred territory for Sarah Doublet. Now, she's a Christianized Indian, in theory, but she's trying to hold on to this piece of territory for her people. And even though none of her people left, I mean, it may not have even been conscious on her part. So that is what attracted me to this individual. I mean, her power, Sarah Doublet's... Her strength of endurance and holding on to this. Even in the end of her life, she was blind and feeble, and yet she held on. Mm. So that's what attracted me to the property and the story. I mean, but quite apart from the fact that it was a good way to tell the history of property rights.
So do you feel that there is something something unusual about this place?
Well... Yeah, I do. I try to be agnostic about it, but a lot of people go down there and have weird experiences. They hear noises, and I never believed any of this. I was down there one night, and I don't know what it was. It was just like mist, cold. I mean, it was a warm night. There was this cold mist passed over me, sort of scared me, terrifying. And, it was right in keeping with what has happened to other people. It's maybe haunted land. Who knows? I mean, there were Indians living there. I mean, this is a known Indian village. It's a deserted village. There's nobody left. And, it's just a weird piece of property. It's very interesting. Very, very visually interesting, too. It's beautiful. Rolling sharp hills with deep valleys and these little... pockets of wetlands down at the bottom, and these strange mounds, and everybody who goes there says, "Oh, this is a great place," and people who go in there at night say have different ideas about it. So I don't know.
I guess to me, what it makes me think about, and I don't know if I'm being overly romantic or not, but maybe the difference. Between the way two people think about a piece of land has to do with whether they think it's alive or not, in a sense, whether it is really simply just it's rocks and dirts and trees and just something that you can pretty much do whatever you want with. It's a basic raw resource, and it's not really more than that. The other side of it is that it is... In and of itself, a living thing, and the two views make one think very differently about your relationship to it, and if you could even think about the idea that thing would be your property or not.
Yeah, that whole view of land, that whole attitude. I mean, there are people who go, well, it's not just this land, but any land, and they feel a certain connection or strength coming up out of the earth in that place, and they say, well, this is a you know, this is a very special place and this shouldn't be developed. And there are others who look at that same piece of property, and what they see there is money. You know, they say, oh, this would make a nice development. Or and it's just this sort of what they call the Cartesian split, you know, that Descartes holds that, you know, we're just irrational beings and the world is a mechanized place, and then there are these sort of the spiritual attitudes toward land. And that, you know, that's a major part. I didn't actually write very much about that, but in the book Trespassing, but that's there's a big sort of, I mean, I mentioned it, but there's a big sort of whole discussion of this piece of property in the books on Indian sacred lands, because it's a lot of people believe that this Neshoba village is you know, an important spiritual site and it has to be preserved for that reason only. You know, and a lot of people, as I said earlier, you know, a lot of people have this feeling when they go there. So, you know, what people feel though, and what the law says, are two different things. And in point of fact, that land and any land is, you know, the whole United States is cut and divided and owned by somebody, either a private individual or the federal government. And so, you know, it's not free.
Mm-hmm. You, unfortunately, we're kind of coming down to the point. We only have a couple of minutes left, but I'm just, you intrigued with one section of the book here where you took a trip to Scotland.
Yes.
To visit something that had, where you have family, a place where you have family roots.
Right. Yeah. This is a small village in outside of Aberdeen, east of Aberdeen, west of Aberdeen. And, yeah, I went back there. I happened to be fairly nearby, and I thought, geez, I should go back to this property. I mean, it's a known place where my family came from. And I went back, and it's, of course, it just went out of the family in the 1930s or 1940s, I guess, and it was owned by, you know, some other family. But it turned out my cousin had been back there, and, I mean, it's a beautiful little village called Kintore. And, you know, I went back and visited there and talked to the people, and actually came, I mean, that deepened my understanding of this whole English roots of our system of private property. I mean, because you see there that, you know, they're like, you have private property, but you also have a lot of rights of way. The public has more rights to be on privately owned land in England than they do here. You have these ancient rights of way that you know, anybody can walk over these old paths. They've been around since the time of William. They're 500 years old, and so it was. Yeah, it was an interesting and instructive trip. I also went down to, and this is another trip down to Kent in the south of England and East Anglia, which is where a lot of the people who came over to the New World came from that region. And interesting thing is that the area around here, where I live, is a lot of fruit growing. And Kent, where the people who settled here came from, is fruit growing district. So here we are, you know, 300 years later, still growing fruit right out of the English tradition.
Well, you know, we're going to have to stop because we're here at the end of the time, and I just want to say to you, thanks very much for talking.
You're quite
welcome. Our guest, John Hanson Mitchell, if you're interested in reading his books, you'd head to the bookstore or the library. His most recent, the one that we've been talking about here this morning, is titled Trespassing, An Inquiry into the Private Ownership of Land. It's published by Addison Wesley.